I want to thank the organizers, David and John, for the invitation to join you here today. I'll give you some background about my job as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Here in California, Minneapolis doesn't seem like the West, but we're on the very western edge of the bank of the Mississippi River, so I think we can count as the West. I'll then talk about two seemingly distinct topics that nonetheless emerge from two related aspects of my job. The first topic is the Bakken oil boom that is underway in western North Dakota and eastern Montana. The second topic is monetary policy, and specifically how the Federal Reserve is doing in terms of achieving its monetary policy goals. And at the end of my remarks, I look forward to taking your questions. Please note, though, that my comments today reflect my own views and not necessarily those of my colleagues in the Federal Reserve. So just to level set, I'm going to begin with some basics about the Federal Reserve System. I'd like to talk about the Fed and think about the Fed as a uniquely American institution. Now, what do I mean when I say that? Well, relative to its counterparts around the world, the U.S. Central Bank is highly decentralized. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis is one of 12 regional reserve banks that, along with the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C., make up the Federal Reserve System. Our bank serves as the headquarters for Federal Reserve operations in the ninth of the 12 Federal Reserve districts. Now, our district is really into the American West because it includes the state of Montana, North and South Dakota, northwestern Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. 8 times per year, the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, meets to make monetary policy. Now, all 12 presidents of the regional Federal Reserve Banks, including myself, and the governors of the Federal Reserve Board contribute to the deliberations about monetary policy. But the voting members of the committee change from year to year. It consists only of the governors. They always vote every year. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York also votes every year. And then a rotating group of 4 other presidents. And this year, I'm one of those 4 presidents. The last time I spoke at CPR actually 3 years ago, so CPR manages to get me every time I'm a voter. So I think the structure of the FOMC mirrors the federalist structure of our own country because the representatives from different regions of the country, the various presidents, have input into FOMC deliberations. Now, this description of the Federal Reserve and how the FOMC works is a good motivation for the two topics that I plan to discuss today. So at each FOMC meeting, Federal Reserve Bank presidents contribute to the discussion of monetary policy in part by commenting on economic conditions within their own districts. So Federal Reserve Bank staff economists work hard to track, understand, and communicate about their district's economies. My discussion of my first topic, the Bakken oil boom, builds on exactly that kind of work that's happening within my own Reserve Bank. Now, as I noted earlier, as a Reserve Bank president, I participate in FOMC meetings that formulate monetary policy for the country. And that participation is the second topic that I plan to discuss today, the Federal Reserve's performance relative to its monetary policy objectives. So that's what I'm going to talk about. I'll talk first about the Bakken oil boom and something of, I think, immense economic interest that's happening within the boundaries of the 9th District. And then I'll move on to talk about national monetary policy and our performance relative to our goals. So with that background in mind, let me turn to my discussion of the Bakken oil boom. So the term the Bakken, which you may have heard, refers to a shale oil formation in northwestern North Dakota and in northeastern Montana. You know, this is basically just showing you the oil production area in these two states. The Bakken oil field covers a large swath in North Dakota and a corner of Montana. We pushed northward, you would see actually pushing a little bit into Canada as well. But the heart of the Bakken, from the point of view of American economists, is around the city of Williston, North Dakota. Correspondingly, most of the oil production in the Bakken is taking place in North Dakota. Now, as it turns out, oil finds are not actually a new phenomenon in North Dakota. Oil deposits were originally discovered in North Dakota in 1951. In what is now known as the Williston Basin. Now, following the run-up in the price of oil in the 1970s, There was a flurry of drilling in the state during the late 1970s and early 1980s. But that boom disappeared when oil prices collapsed in the mid-1980s. So by the mid-2000s, oil production in North Dakota was less than 100,000 barrels per day. That is less than 2% of total U.S. oil production. So this is around, you know, and I'll show you the picture in a few minutes, but this is around the mid-2000s, as I say, that oil production in North Dakota was very low relative to the total in the U.S. What changed 10 years ago was technological innovation. That there was a combination of the horizontal exploration of shale formations along with what's called hydraulic fracturing or fracking. This process, I'm sure many of you in the room have heard about and probably much more expert about than I am. The process just revolutionized oil and gas production throughout the country and around the world. In the Bakken region in particular, this technological change, the ability to drill, to do horizontal drilling and fracking, has meant that what was impenetrable rock is now a motherlode of oil that encompasses nearly 15,000 square miles. So thanks to the Bakken, the state of North Dakota is currently producing over 1 million barrels of oil a day, over 10 times what it produced 10 years ago, and over 7 times what it produced at the peak of the 1980s boom. So North Dakota has gone from producing about 2% of U.S. oil production. It's now responsible for an eighth of U.S. total crude oil production and over 1% of total world oil production. So this slide shows a rapid increase in daily oil production in North Dakota. You know, as I was describing, basically you see that doesn't go back all the way to the 80s. It only goes back to the 2000s. But you see basically we're around 100,000 barrels a day until around 2006 when things take off. You can see here that there's a little bit of a downward blip in oil production. And that's related to the fact that oil prices actually went down pretty low during this period. Now, this is the government of North Dakota's projections for state oil production. And these projections include anticipated production from what's called the Three Forks. The Three Forks is another large shale formation, which is located beneath the Bakken. So the Bakken is first, and then even below that, there's more oil in what's called the Three Forks. And if you build on that, you can look at, see what the projections are going to be. The main takeaway from this should be that you're expected to have production going out for quite some time. So you look at peak here, you know, this is really around in the late 2020s or so. So quite some time down the road. Okay. So this is all in terms of just what's going on in terms of the quantities of oil that's been produced in the past and the explosion of oil production. So what's happened in terms of the economy as a result of this? Now, by most usual economic metrics, the oil boom has been associated with a large improvement in the North Dakota economy. If we go back to 2006, per capita real gross state product in North Dakota, so essentially the equivalent of GDP in North Dakota, per person was about 10% lower in North Dakota than it was in the nation as a whole. Over the next 7 years, though, North Dakota per capita real GSP, gross state product, grew rapidly. So much so that by 2013, it was about 40% higher than U.S. per capita real GDP. I have to say this again, because it is an amazing statistic. In 2006, North Dakota was 10% below the national per capita average of GDP. It is now 40% above. Okay. Now, the fiscal impact, so this is all just that's in terms of income, GDP for North Dakotans, the fiscal impact in the state has been even more dramatic. So if you go back, North Dakota operates on a biennial basis for their state legislature. The 2003 to 2005 biennium, the state of North Dakota collected about $120 million in taxes from oil and gas production. That $120 million is projected to top $5 billion in the 2013 to 2015 biennium. Now, here in California, $5 billion may not sound like very much, but in North Dakota, it's a very large amount of money. It's about $7,000 for every man, woman, and child in the state. That's just the direct tax collections. More generally, the state's tax revenues have tripled in the past 6 years. Now, these are remarkable measures at the statewide level. But one of the things we've been struck by at the Minneapolis Fed in our studies of the Bakken is we've been struck by what might be called the localness of the Bakken's impact. The localness impact phenomenon is depicted in terms of wages on this chart. So this is describing the growth, the evolution of wages, average weekly wages, by distance from the core Bakken counties. So the blue graph shows you what's happening to wages within the Bakken counties themselves. Now you go to the orange graph, and you see what's happening 0 to 100 miles away in terms of growth in average weekly wages. And you still see growth, right? Certainly, but nowhere near as much as what you've seen in the Bakken counties. So we're just going 100 miles away, and you're already seeing a diminution in impact, according to what's happening to wages. You get further than that, 100, 200 miles away, 200, 300 miles away, and you really start to see a die-off in the impact on wages. Now, so an economist's point of view, this is very interesting because of the fact that if you think about labor as being a very mobile kind of input, you would have expected to see much tighter relationship. I would have thought, I'll just speak for myself, I would have thought you would have seen a much tighter relationship. But here we see, you know, even going out to 200 miles or so, 200, 300 miles, you're really starting to see a real diminution in terms of the impact of what's happening on the price of labor. Now, all told, though, I would say that in terms of the usual economic metrics, the Bakken boom has been a big positive for the state of North Dakota. Nonetheless, and you'll be talking about, I suspect, some of these challenges in terms of development, the boom has created large challenges for the state. The increased production has been an influx of people and a spike in strains on existing infrastructure. Now, there are a myriad of ways to see those strains, and I'll just offer a few anecdotal examples that is reported on our website. So one aspect of this is just in terms of population growth. In the North Dakota Bakken areas, one growth expert that we interviewed describes 1 to 3%, a 3% population growth is robust. At 4 to 5%, things, in his words, are busting out of the seams. In McKenzie County, so this is in the heart of the Bakken area, the growth rate of the population is 8% per year and is expected to grow at that pace for 10 more years. Okay. So this is, how can you possibly keep up with that kind of population growth in terms of infrastructure? So this, I should emphasize here, this is the average across the Bakken counties. There are more than one of those. So some counties are actually growing even faster this in terms of population. This is the rest of North Dakota, and population growth is close to 2%, and the rest of the United States, as I'm sure most of you know, is growing at around 0.9%. So North Dakota has certainly seen an influx of population, but it's really here in the Bakken that you see an enormous increase in population. Now, one way this shows up in terms of an economic sense is in terms of prices, and in particular the prices for shelter. So if you look at, and this is an amazing statistic, rental rates in Williston reported to be the highest in the country at over $2,000 per month for an entry-level one-bedroom apartment. So this is Williston, North Dakota. Rental rates in Dickinson, North Dakota were ranked fourth in the nation. So there's Dickinson. Now, there's certainly some parts, I suspect, in this part of the world where you can, you're thinking 2,000 may not sound that bad, but in Williston, this certainly sounds like a fairly high price. The response to this has been in terms of trying to build, of course, and you get these kind of explosion in rents, people respond to that economic incentive. So, for example, in Williston, 49 permits were issued to build apartments in 2013. This contrasts, that's in 1 year, in 2013. This contrasts from the 2000 to 2006 period, when no apartment building permits were issued in Williston. So another issue has been what's called flaring. If you've had a chance to go out there, one of the things that strikes you is, especially at night, is all the flaring of natural gas you'll see from the wells. This flaring is releasing carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, as a byproduct of combustion. But recent state regulations that have been enacted are expected to spur increases in gas capture and reduce the proportion of wells that are flaring gas. One of the key inputs into fracking is water. And it's become an increasingly important issue as industries and communities vie for this key resource. So in the city of Williston alone, water upgrades over the next 6 years are projected to cost $250 million. In total, new infrastructure will cost the city $625 million over that time. Now, smaller towns are especially feeling the infrastructure squeeze. The city of Arnagard, North Dakota, if you haven't heard of it before, I hadn't heard of it before either. It has a resident population of just over 100 people. But it now has a service population of over 1,600. It's still a small town, but it's grown by 16 times. They don't have public water. Their sewer system is overrun and outdated. They were less than underprepared, said one state official. So I think this is an important part to keep in mind, that this boom, which is definitely delivered positives in terms of the usual economic metrics, has created challenges as well. Nonetheless, I do have confidence in the ability of North Dakotans to solve them. One source of my confidence I already mentioned. It's a 40-fold increase in tax revenues from oil and gas production that the state has experienced. These revenues represent resources that can go a long way toward ameliorating the kind of infrastructure strains that I've mentioned. Now, let me close my discussion of the Bakken boom by discussing what I see as the biggest opportunity and the challenge that the boom creates, namely the long-term development issues. Now, over the next 20 years, the world economy will continue to evolve technologically. Of course, we do not know exactly what course that evolution will take. But I suspect that as has been true over the past two centuries, the evolution of technology will continue to favor the better educated, and especially those who have acquired skills associated with science, technology, engineering, mathematics. How will the residents of the Bakken and North Dakota choose to engage with this process of global technological change over the next 2 to 3 decades? I think the windfall of the Bakken oil boom gives them the ability to answer this question in exciting ways that would have seemed impossible a decade ago. So that's what I wanted to say about my first topic, give you a feel of what's happening in the Bakken. Let me now turn to my second topic, monetary policy. So what I'm going to do, I don't want to tip my hand too much when I talk about them. I will describe the goals the FOMC seeks to achieve through its monetary policy choices. And I'll discuss how the committee has done in terms of achieving those goals over the past 7 years, since the onset of the Great Recession in late 2007. And I'll close about talking about my outlook for the evolution of inflation, and then how that outlook affects my thinking about current monetary policy choices. So if you're going to talk about monetary policy goals for the Federal Reserve, the natural starting point is the Federal Reserve Act. And that's the law that Congress passed to create the Federal Reserve back in 1913. Through the Federal Reserve Act, Congress requires the Federal Reserve to make monetary policy so as to promote effectively the goals of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. Now, most economists believe that if the Fed is able to achieve the first two goals, max employment and stable prices, it would achieve the third, moderate long-term interest rates. So monetary policymakers are typically described as having a dual mandate to promote price stability and to promote maximum employment. So that's what you get out of Congress, is that's what we're supposed to do, promote maximum employment, promote price stability when we make monetary policy. Now, it's the foundation for what we do when we make monetary policy, but it doesn't address a lot of specifics. So in January 2012, in a key milestone in the evolution of the Fed's communications, the FOMC adopted a longer and more precise description of the long-run goals. So I'll call the associated short but path-breaking document the framework statement. It contains a lot of important ideas, and all Americans should read it. because I, you know, the monetary policy is very important for everybody in the economy. And this really is a very clear communication of what we're trying to achieve when we go about making monetary policy. But today I'll stress just two main elements. The first is the framework statement explicitly translates the words price stability into a longer run goal of a 2% annual inflation rate. And here the term inflation rate refers specifically to the personal consumption expenditures, or PCE inflation rate. This is a little bit different from the CPI, which you usually hear, a consumer price index that you usually hear about. Basically, we've done a lot of study in the Fed. We feel this does a better job of capturing the prices, the growth of prices at, in the overall economy. The main thing I want to emphasize is this is a measure of the rate of increase of all the prices of all goods and services, including those related to food and energy. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about core inflation that takes out food and energy goods. And I'll explain why we do that in a few minutes. But when we talk about trying to achieve 2% inflation, it's for all goods and services, not just not stripping out food and energy goods. I think this adoption of this 2% target is very important. It means that the American public need no longer guess about the intentions of the FOMC, either on the upside or on the downside. 2% is our goal. The second piece of the framework statement, which I think is important, is it describes how the committee weighs the two mandates, promoting max employment, promoting price stability, against one another. And I think it makes it a really important point that's too often missed in the conversation about monetary policy. And that is that the two mandates are typically complementary to one another. Monetary policy pushes employment and inflation in the same direction. We provide stimulus, it pushes employment and inflation upward. If we take stimulus away, it pushes employment and inflation downward. That's from the point that most shocks that hit the economy do the same thing. Most shocks that push employment down also tend to push inflation down over the medium run, and vice versa. The Bakken, which I talked about, is a great example of this phenomenon. The fracking boom has driven up both employment and prices, most notably shelter prices, but that's what I stress, but it fits into a number of prices around the area. So monetary stimulus that's designed to help the FOMC achieve its employment goals will also help the FOMC achieve its inflation goals, and vice versa. Okay, so that's the two things I wanted to stress about our goals. One is we're targeting 2% inflation, and not something below that, not something above that, and that trying to that the two objectives of promoting max employment and promoting price stability are actually typically complementary to one another. So those are objectives, and now I want to talk about how we've done relative to those objectives over the past few years. This performance provides a clear example of the complementarity of the two mandates that I've just mentioned. Okay, so I've been desperate to show this slide, so now I'm going to turn to it. So in terms of the employment mandate, labor market outcomes, while they've been improving, have been distressingly weak since 2007. So we can see this weak performance in a number of ways, but I'll use two particular metrics. One is you hear about all the time, the unemployment rate. So this is a graph of the unemployment rate going back to the early 80s. And the gray shaded areas represent recession periods as dated by the National Bureau of Economic Research. The far right recession area is what's called typically called the Great Recession. It starts in December 2007 and ends in June of 2009. And you can see the unemployment rate was below 5% in the early part of 2007. But during the Great Recession, it zoomed upward, and it kept rising even after the recession ended. And in the fall of 2009, it peaked at 10%. It's been coming down pretty steadily since then, and it's now down to 5.8%. This is one metric, one lens through which to view the labor market. The way that unemployment rate is calculated is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics asks people, do you have a job? And if you don't have if you have a job, you're counted as employed. Then they ask, if you don't have a job, have you looked for one in the past 4 weeks? And those people are called unemployed. And then the unemployment rate is the fraction of people who are unemployed relative to the sum of the people who are employed and unemployed. That means the unemployment rate can come down for one of two reasons. One is because more people are becoming employed, or because fewer people say they've looked for a job in the past 4 weeks. A large amount of the decline that we've seen in the unemployment rate over the past 5+ years has actually been coming from people saying that they're not looking for a job. They have not looked for a job in the past 4 weeks. And you can see this by looking at the fraction of people over the age of 16 who have a job. This picture going into during the recession, again, this is the gray shaded area, is the Great Recession. This period, in a lot of ways, it mirrors what happened in the previous chart, right? You're down, this is just the inverse image. You're down here, it zooms up. You're down here, and it collapses. That's just the, one was the unemployment rate going up. This is the employment, people who have a job is going down. This is around over 63% of the people who have a job. Now, down here, it's really closer to 58%. We've seen relatively little recovery in this picture compared to the picture I just showed you. So in this sense, the unemployment rate is providing an overly optimistic perspective on the improvement in the labor market. We've seen, the last year, we've seen some noticeable improvement, I would say, in this fraction. If I had given this talk a year ago, it would have been very hard to see any improvement at all. Now we're up to 59.2% when we're really down in the low 58s for much of the post-recession time frame. Now, this is a little misleading to look at this. I mean, more than a little, because of the demographic issue. You know, the people who are over the age of 16 includes the baby boom. And the fraction of that group of people is going to be heading into retirement age. And we'd expect them to drop out of the labor force and stop working as they start to hit that retirement time frame. One of the way we've tried to strip that out of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and other people do this as well, is to focus on people who are aged 25 to 54. And here, you know, I think that, again, you see the same picture of you're above 80% right before the recession, collapse during the recession, and then you start to see improvement. I think you see the demographics are real because you see more of an improvement in this number, the employment ratio 25 to 54, than I did in this one. But again, I think the unemployment rate is providing an overly optimistic perspective on the degree of improvement we see in the labor market performance. So that's all on the employment front. What about inflation? So on the inflation front, this is PC inflation over the last, I don't go back all the way to the 80s, but going back to 2007. Since December 2007, since the Great Recession started, inflation has averaged 1.5% per year. Remember, our target is 2, so we've been averaging below that target that whole time. One thing I want to point out in this picture, though, is I told you that sometimes people take out food and energy prices, the prices of food and energy, goods and services, and look at core inflation. And the reason they do that is they want to know where inflation is going to go in the future. When we make monetary policy, we can't affect the prices of goods and services tomorrow or today. It's affecting the prices of goods and services with a 1 to 2 year lag. So we want to know where inflation is going to be heading. CORE does a better job of telling us where inflation is going to go than if we include energy, goods, and services. And you see just a great example of this in July. This is mid-2008. I know the price of gas is well over $4 in this state at that time. And that shows up in the inflation rate. Because oil and gasoline went up so much, you see inflation is at 4% in an annual rate here. This would not have been a good signal where inflation was going to go in the future, though. Gas prices collapsed and oil prices collapsed during the latter part of 2008, and that shows up now in a very negative inflation rate. CORE does a better job. It's not perfect, of course, but it does a better job of tracking what's going to be happening with inflation, because energy movements in energy goods, gasoline in particular, very volatile, tends to be transitory. Doesn't tell you where inflation is going to be going. Where are we now? Inflation right now is at 1.4%. This is all goods and services, PC inflation. I've told you you want to be looking at CORE. If I looked at CORE instead of headline, so all goods and services, just took out the food and energy goods, we'd be at 1.5%. So inflation pressures remain very subdued in the U.S. relative to the FOMC's target. What's the takeaway from all this? The shock of 2007, the Great Recession, pushed both employment and inflation in the same direction, below our goals. So the two mandates have been entirely complementary over the past 7 years. Monetary policy has been insufficiently accommodative to offset either the price or employment shock effects of this large shock. So I now want to turn to my inflation outlook and its implications for policy. Now, as you can see from the graph before you, inflation has been low for a long time. Inflation tends to be highly persistent. And so this long stay below target we see, especially more recently, but just over the whole time frame, suggests to me that it'll take some time for inflation to get back to 2%. My own benchmark outlook is that PC inflation will not rise back to 2% until 2018, so 4 years from now. The minutes from the September FOMC meeting note that the Board of Governors staff in Washington currently project inflation will remain below 2% over the next few years. So this inflation outlook has important implications for my outlook for the appropriate evolution of monetary policy. Many observers have suggested that the FOMC should begin to tighten credit conditions by raising its target range for the Fed funds rate at some point in 2015. So there's a lot of conversation about that possibility. But given the lags associated with monetary policy, which I mentioned, the 1 to 2 year ahead lags, such a move would lower anticipated inflation over the following 1 to 2 years. So if you were gonna raise rates in 2015, that's gonna push inflation even further away from our 2% goal. So in my current outlook, it would be inappropriate for the FOMC to raise interest rates during 2015. So I wanna make two comments about that conclusion. First, I've made no reference to the falling unemployment rate or the improvement in the employment population ratio. So the falling unemployment rate, improvement in the employment population ratio, I've made no reference to those. I don't see a falling unemployment rate or an increasing employment population ratio as a reason to tighten policy unless that change is generating undue inflationary pressures. And the essence of my inflation outlook is that despite recent and anticipated falls in the unemployment rate, I don't see such pressures at this time. The second point is, of course, this conclusion is dependent on the data. My inflation outlook could rise. We could get information that would push it in that direction. And then my preferred date of interest rate liftoff would come forward in time, possibly into 2015. Let me wrap up and throw the floor open for questions. I've discussed two disparate topics, the Bakken oil boom and appropriate monetary policy. I say these topics are disparate, but I see them as connected. I don't form my views about appropriate monetary policy based on conditions in the Bakken. I have to admit that if I did, I would have different monetary policy conclusions. But the Bakken is a great example of what a booming economy looks like. It's an economy that is actually pushing the limits of available resources, not an economy that's operating well within those limits of available resources. It's an example that I have found highly instructive as I continue to think about the degree of economic slack left at the national level. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to taking your questions.